And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
We are off and running. Training camp is done. The preseason has begun. This is our first Drantzless episode of the VanCast. I don't, you know, I'm not sure that's going to be the same. It'll take some getting used to, but Harm and I are confident we're going to be able to deliver you a fantastic show as we move forward through the 22-23 season. We will have Drantz later in the week. We'll tell you how that's going to play out. But more importantly for the Canucks right now, who are coming off a split squad set of preseason games on Sunday against Calgary, is they're going to be without one of their top players for the next 3 to 4 weeks. News just came out that the Canucks will lose Brock Besser. Just had surgery on his hand. Did not play in those games, and Bruce Boudreau had been pretty quiet about what the injury was and didn't seem to think it was going to be that serious, but wasn't going to commit to him practicing when the club got back on the ice Tuesday. Now we know why. Besser, hand surgery out 3 to 4 weeks. A tough break, literally and figuratively, Harm, for a player that's had a bit of an injury history, and it continues going into the first year of a new contract.
Yeah, what a shame. I mean, it just feels like Besser can't catch a break. After the offseason that he went through, losing his father, and to hear everybody on the team talk about how confident they are that Besser's was going to have a huge season, and that's still possible, but this definitely throws a wrench into the situation. I mean, the first day of camp, Brock was asked about the 30-goal milestone as could he get there, and Brock was unequivocal, answered right away, no hesitation, and said, this is the year. I'm going to do it. This is the year. And when I thought about the possibility of Brock scoring 30 goals this season, the number one thing I thought of was definitely has the ability level, because when you look at his career numbers, he's actually scored at right about a 30 goal per 82 games pace. It's just the durability, right? He hasn't been able to stay healthy. Obviously, in the 2021 campaign, he was going to hit 30, but it was only a 56-game season, and he was at least healthy for that entire year. So it hasn't always been durability-related, but for him to go down, it's such a blow, especially because with Besser's game, he seems like the sort of player who benefits from having a preseason to ramp up and get back up to speed, because his skating, we all know, isn't a strong suit of his game. He's good at a lot of things. He's a really smart player. He's got a really good shot. But for Besser to find success as a scorer, he's the sort of guy that he needs to kind of shake the rust off of his skating and be at his best to create enough space to get his shot off consistently, particularly at even strength. And without camp and preseason, I do wonder if it's, when he does return, going to take him some time to ramp back up and be comfortable with his pace and find enough opportunities to get a shot off. And what does a shot look like once his hand does fully recover? Is it going to be a 100% from day one? A lot of questions now thrown into the equation, and I just feel so bad for the guy. He's gone through so much adversity, and it just felt like this was the time for him to turn a page, not have the pressure of a contract year on him as well. And now now he's out for the start of the season, you would think.
Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, it's tough for Brock just because he is a player that, you know, the emotional side of it and the confidence side of it does tend to waver with him a little bit, right? And, you know, we certainly can't view what he dealt with his father as a distraction, because that just so trivializes what he was going through. Right. And, you know, it would affect anybody, and it should affect anybody. But the injury piece, I think, is very real, and that has had an impact. And then you go through the ebbs and flows of a season where, when things aren't going well for him offensively, the impact that has on other ends of his game. And sometimes he's just hard to notice when he's not scoring. And he will tell you himself that it affects other parts of his games, and you know, and that he's either confident or he's not. And he knows when he's not confident. We can all see when he's not confident. So you're right. I think it will affect the start of his season, right? I mean, if it's closer to 3 weeks, he doesn't necessarily have to miss a lot of game action, but that preseason is going to matter for him. So, you know, we'll see what it winds up looking like for him. But yeah, I mean, you know, he basically said like that there weren't any excuses for him, that this was the year he had to make that jump. And we all understood that it was all going to come down to his health. So, you know, hopefully it's not, you know, closer to the end, 4 weeks or more. Hopefully it can happen a little bit sooner and he doesn't have to miss a lot in the way of regular season games, just so that he can kind of get back feeling better about himself and we're not having to see this kind of affect his game until Christmas or things like that, that it could have a bit more of a shorter term impact both for him and for the club. And I say him first because you're right. Like, I just feel for the guy, right? Because there's always something, you know, and the father thing is significant, you know, but then the injury thing is also something that he's had to wear throughout his career or the beginning of the season and, you know, contracts and things like that. Like, that's always played a part. He's always had a tough time removing himself from the emotion of that level of adversity for a guy that, you know, when you look back at his collegiate career and his time with the you know, with the U.S. national team program as a youngster. And, you know, there's always been something, and he's always shown a tremendous amount of resiliency. We'll see if he can do that going forward here. And then how does it affect the Canucks? Because we've talked about what the lines look like and what Bruce Boudreau wanted for his lines coming into the year, right? And it certainly seemed as though Besser was going to be on that line with Miller and Pearson, a group that could be deployed in so many different situations. Now he's out, and we've seen a guy like Nils Höglander, who we're going to talk about a little bit later in the show in greater detail, but a guy that's looked good in camp and a guy that you could say, okay, he can easily plunk himself into the lineup, but does he instantly fit on that line with Miller and Pearson, or is it going to have a greater impact in that lineup? And also consider the fact we don't know what's going to happen with Mikheyev because he got injured in the game here. Didn't finish that game, and we're not going to know more until Tuesday because the Canucks are off Monday. You know, so they could be looking at two potential forward openings, not just one, at least in the short term.
Yeah, this is just classic Canucks luck, isn't it? It's just so unfortunate. And when I think about constructing the top nine now, for now, I'll hopefully, fingers crossed, assume that Mikheyev's still in the equation. But when you talk about, for instance, could Höglander slide right into the spot with Pearson and Miller? Obviously, he's going to slot into the top nine somewhere, but I don't know if Miller and Pearson is the best spot for him necessarily. I'd be thinking about sort of reconstructing the top nine as a whole. And the reason I say that is because with Besser, what he brought to the table is above average finishing ability. And when you looked at the success of Miller, Pearson, and Besser as a trio and why that worked, the way they were able to control play down low with Pearson doing a lot of the dirty work to retrieve the puck, that would set Miller up to have the puck on his stick a ton, and Miller would essentially be the playmaker, and that would then leave Brock to be off of the puck and find the soft spots in the slot and essentially just be the trigger man and clinical finisher for that line. And when I think about Nils Höglander's game, he's good at a lot of things. He's a dynamic playmaker. He can make a lot of plays with the puck on his stick, but that's not what that line needs, in my opinion, because you've got Miller with them. What Miller needs is a clinical finisher in the slot who can read off of the defense, find open ice, and just let it rip. And so I don't think that's... I mean, maybe that line can work in some other capacity. Maybe there's a different way for them to work off of the rush or something. But I don't think that's a seamless fit necessarily. And so when I instead think about, okay, who's an above average finisher who's smart in terms of finding soft ice? A winger, obviously. You'd need there who I could plunk in there. I think potentially about Pod Colson. And if you do that, you're all of a sudden reconstructing the top nine. So this is the sort of top nine that I'd be thinking about. Obviously, and this depends on if you want to. I think Höglander could work on either Pettersson or Horvat's line, to be totally honest with you. If you want to keep Mikheyev, Pettersson, and Kuzmenko together, that allows you to sort of continue rolling with that trio, allows them to continue building chemistry. And you can maybe just slot Höglander in with Garland and Horvat. And I think Horvat and Hoglander have shown chemistry together in the past. When you think about Hoglander's rookie season and how he found success, it was with Bo. And now that I actually talk myself through it more and more, I think that's probably the fit that I'd lean towards, because you're able to keep the top line intact. And
what about Kuzmenko? What about Kuzmenko? Like, what about a player like that who's a finisher right now and could potentially benefit from that? I know they want to separate I know they want to keep Pearson and Kuzmenko on the left side. You know, can he move over to the right? Could he be a fit alongside of Miller?
Maybe, but when you have Pearson on that line and considering the minutes that Miller played last season, my guess with, especially because they also put Besser there, who has taken a lot of strides in his 2A game. My guess is that Boudreaux was constructing that line not necessarily to be a matchup line the way Travis Green used to deploy Horvat's line, but I think Boudreaux was preparing to use that line a lot in minutes against the other team's best players, and I don't think Kuzmenko's ready for that. Boudreaux said that he's not ready for that after the first day of camp, so I'd sort of for now prefer to keep Kuzmenko there. And then to have Horvat and Hoglander together, what really worked about them as a duo was Hoglander was, in his first season, really good at making plays off the defensive half wall. He was really quick at receiving the puck from the defensive half wall and helping with his own exits. And that works really well because with Horvat's skill set, he doesn't play like a traditional center. A lot of centers are involved. Like when you look at Pettersson, he's really involved in breaking the puck out. His zone exit numbers in terms of helping carry the puck through the neutral zone are really high. But you look at Horvat's profile, historically, he's a guy who doesn't necessarily come deep. And it's because Horvat is his most dangerous when he's the first man up the ice leading the rush. And he has someone to feed him, to spring him in stride. And that's what Hoglander was really good at. And that's why I'd like to see them have chemistry, especially with a guy like Garland, who also has some playmaking upside, and you have two playmakers then on the wings to feed Bo as a trigger man, and you don't have Horvat taking on as much of a playmaking load. So that's my initial thought, is I would rather maybe have Hoglander with Horvat and then bump Podkolzin up, just because he fits a little bit better as a trigger man.
All right, we'll get into those lines and some of those players and talk a bit more about their camp, both Podkolzin, Hoglander, and others as the show continues. I do want to get into the defense a little bit, though, as we transition away from the Besser injury, which, of course, is tough news, which is going to impact all elements of the team. But let's talk a bit about the blue line, because that was such a question coming into this. And we saw Quinn Hughes, he didn't play in the preseason games, but we've seen him in training camp play alongside of OEL and play on that right side almost exclusively through those first three practices. Just what have you seen from Hughes on the right side first? Let's start there in terms of his comfort level in that spot and his comfort level playing with OEL.
It's been remarkable seeing the growth just from the start to the end of Whistler. I remember the first scrimmage where Hughes played the right side, he looked like a player who was uncomfortable. He just didn't look like the Quinn Hughes we're used to seeing. It's not that he necessarily looked bad. He just looked normal. And I'm so used to seeing Hughes look superhuman. And there were instincts there that you could see Hughes was still, for example, when he was trying to rush the puck up on breakouts, the only time he'd be able to do that successfully is when he'd move diagonally to the left side, and then OEL would have to shift to the right. And so it was a little bit awkward there. And then the angles were also different on breakout passes. So it was uncharacteristic to see Hughes try to make breakout passes with the different angles and him not being able to hit the mark, right? Because for as much as Hughes has this dynamic quality as a puck rusher, I think one of the most underrated parts about his game is that consistently as a stretch passer, he's always tape to tape, always sends a flat pass that's easy to receive. And that just wasn't there in the first scrimmage. But then you watch him in the second scrimmage and he looked like he'd been playing the right side for 10 years with the way that he was able to dominate. He was the best player on both sides during that scrimmage, just dynamic. And you saw the qualities of just being able to totally tilt the ice. And if you're going to go with OEL and Hughes, that's what you need. You're not just looking for a pair that's going to be good together. You're looking for a pair that needs to be elite, that needs to be one of the best first pairs in the NHL, because the trickle-down effect of playing OEL and Hughes together is that you're leaving the rest of the bottom four in a pretty vulnerable spot. And so we saw elements of that in that second scrimmage. And to me, it's mind-blowing how quickly Hughes has been able to look comfortable in that spot, at least in a scrimmage environment, because moving to the right side, playing your offside, and of course he's had some experience doing it a little bit with the University of Michigan, a little bit more with the U.S. National Team Development Program, but it's a massive change. There's a reason why defensemen are rarely able to make that transition, and it's because your body position is totally different when you're playing the puck. Playing the offside, your torso isn't fully facing up the ice, which is where you usually have to make the next play on the breakout. And I talked to Travis Dermott about this, who has a lot of experience with it. He says you just create so many blind spots on your offside where when you get the puck, your eyes and your body are facing your partner east-west rather than up the ice, which is where you actually have to carry it or make your next play. And so as a result, you're thrown in a lot of awkward positions where it's easy to panic. And that's why Dermott told me that confidence and a high panic threshold is the number one trait to excelling on your offside. It's all mental. And that's where, and I think that's why Hughes has been able to, at least in that scrimmage environment, been able to find that success, because he is so calm, cool, and collected. Quinn Hughes doesn't know what pressure is. He doesn't know what panic is. There's just zero qualities of that game, of that in his game. And that's, I think, why he's been able to make the transition seamlessly. Obviously, it's a lot different in the offensive zone as well, because one of the best parts of his game is being able to dart down the wall on his left side and then being able to cut back and make plays. So I wondered, when you're on your right side, different body position, I worried a little bit about taking that dynamic quality away from him. But then I was able to talk to Bill McCault, who is the associate head coach at Michigan. And he's, of course, coached Quinn Hughes, but he's also coached Luke Hughes. And at Michigan, the Wolverines have used Luke Hughes on the right side permanently. And McCault said, look, I see so many similarities between Quinn and Luke, and the moves that Luke is able to pull off are so magnificent, and I know Quinn can pull those off on his right side too. And the advantage then of Quinn playing on his offside is that if you're able to beat the man at the point, it's so much easier to cut to the middle compared to the left side. And that makes you so much more dangerous as a scorer. So I think from an offensive standpoint, for Hughes to translate, it's going to be interesting to see if his shot can pop, because Hughes has everything. The one area we've been waiting to maybe see a little bit of evolution with is his finishing ability. And he's talked a lot about how he's tirelessly worked on that this summer. So can he make that transition and be a more effective goal scorer? I think that's going to be interesting to see. But for me, overall, when I look at the OEL Hughes pairing, I'm not worried about, are they going to be successful? Like, that's a given. They're going to be great together. Hughes is going to be great on the right side. Maybe there's some bumps on the way, but he'll figure it out. For me, it's about how will the rest of the blue line shake up in the 35 minutes or so when OEL and Hughes aren't on the ice together.
Well, and that's the key, right? Because when you look at how the top four is constructed, let's agree that no matter what, the second pair right side defenseman is going to be Tyler Myers, right? So either Hughes goes back to the left and somebody else plays on his right side because it won't be Myers, or Hughes is on the right and Myers slots in right behind him. Is that a reasonable given?
I think that's plan A, but there's also, I mean, if you're committed to OEL Hughes your top pair, what about, Dermot Myers, I'm worried about them in terms of both guys that like to make plays with the puck, and they're both mistake prone. Pullman is is way less dynamic. He's obviously not as good as Myers, but he's more of a settle things down, be a defensive safety net. And if you're committed,
Harm, in terms of timeline, in terms of the amount of time they're going to play, I don't see any world where Tyler Myers does not get the second most minutes on the right side.
But here's the thing. Myers doesn't necessarily need to be on the second pair on paper to play second pair minutes. Well, for example, you look at the 2019.
So that's fair. So that's fair, right? Because that in those cases, he gets moved around a little bit, right? But like in terms of, yeah, just how they play him and how Boudreaux uses him, I just see him there. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is, how does your top four look best in terms of minute deployed, right? Minute deployment, right? Like, is it best with Myers and Dermott? And, you know, you think that may not be how it winds up playing out, or are you better off with Hughes still on the left with OEL behind you and then Shen playing alongside of Hughes again with Myers in a second pair with OEL, because we know they were effective last year, right? So when you break it down as a top four, what's the better solution right now?
I don't have the answer to that. And I don't think the Canucks have the answer to that right now. It's something that they're going to have to continue to weigh, especially because for me, Myers was really effective last season in that matchup role. And he was really thrown to the wolves in terms of how difficult his minutes are. And alongside OEL, he didn't have to be the primary driver. He had another high quality partner to sort of play off of. And whether it's in a position with Dermott, or whether he's, you know, even in a scenario where he's sliding down and playing with someone like Jack Rathbone, Myers now all of a sudden wouldn't have that safety net. And I want to put him in a position to succeed, because when he's with OEL, he looked fine as a number four defenseman. He was able to move the puck. He was reliable enough defensively. And that pair, in extremely difficult minutes, they were able to hold their own. And I think that's a big reason why the Canucks at 5-on-5 were a lot more effective as a team last season. And if you remove that OEL support from Myers, I don't know how he's going to look. Whether it's with someone like Dermott, because Dermott, for example, plays a really erratic game and he hasn't proven himself as a top four guy. I really like a lot of parts of Dermott's game as a puck mover, as someone who's mobile, who escapes pressure well, and he's driven third pair results really well. But he had every opportunity, for example, in Toronto to stake claim on a top four role on the right side before the Leafs went out and acquired Brody, and he wasn't able to take advantage of it. Maybe the fresh start in Vancouver is enough for him to make that transition. Sometimes guys just need that extra opportunity. But I just look at Dermott Myers and I'm like, that would be a pretty erratic pair, in my opinion. And I just want to put Myers in a position to succeed. So I think the logic of playing OEL and Hughes together requires, whether it's Dermott, whether it's Rathbone, or whether it's a DeKaiser, it requires one of those sorts of players to really break out and show that they can effectively play top 4 minutes. And I don't know if you can bank on that right now.
Well, and especially DeKaiser, who certainly brings a size element to the blue line if the Canucks wind up signing him. But if you listen to Bruce Boudreau's comments following the preseason game here in Vancouver, you know, where he suggested that, yeah, he looked a little nervous, and a guy that's kind of feeling the pressure of playing on a PTO, he's got some work to do, right? I mean, he certainly, when I look at his game so far in this one and the reports that I've read as to what he looked like in camp in those 3 days, I don't know that he's in the top seven at this point. He's going to have to really show something the rest of the way in preseason if the club's going to sign him at all, whether or not, even if they sign him, I mean, there's still every opportunity they sign him to send him to Abbotsford.
Definitely not. And with DeKaiser, the foot speed, I just couldn't get over it. And this is a player, obviously, I can understand why the Canucks gave him a PTO, right? He had played a top four shutdown role for Detroit for a long time in the last couple seasons. Injuries just wore him down and he just wasn't the same player. It was worth a PTO to see if can he skate better. And if he does, he's long and rangy. But aside from the size, I haven't seen anything, whether it be the puck skills, whether it be the movement, whether it be how he's played off of Myers. I just haven't really seen a fit there at all. And there was one drill in particular in Whistler, which really worried me, where, look, Ilya Mikheyev is going to beat 80-90% of defensemen up ice. So it's not that he beat DeKaiser in and of itself that concerned me. There was just a rush sort of drill where the ease and the distance with which he completely floored DeKaiser, I was like, oh my God, that's a big issue, because today's NHL isn't like 5-10 years ago. 5-10 years ago, you could trust that NHL teams would maybe only have elite speed at the top of their lineup, and you could maybe shelter a guy and play him in a prescribed role. And if a defenseman like DeKaiser didn't have great foot speed, maybe he could still survive against the middle competition. But now you look around at the Pacific Division, almost every team has a burner in their middle six. LA has Trevor Moore, who can absolutely fly. You're going to have Dylan Dubé on Calgary. Ryan McLeod is Edmonton's third line center and can and his wheels for days. Chandler Stephenson in Vegas is an absolute nightmare for defensemen. The Ducks have so many fast young forwards. I worry about DeKaiser and how can you put him in a spot to succeed? Because you look at a player like Luke Shen and you can say, yeah, he doesn't have the foot speed, but the difference is Shen at least has puck skills and can make the first pass. And alongside a dynamic guy like Hughes, it was much less of an issue. Whereas when I look at DeKaiser and I look at the gap between him and let's say Shen, and the reason I'm comparing those guys is because they're both not exactly fleet of foot, and you're thinking about how could DeKaiser fit at the NHL level. I just think he's looked so far away right now. Maybe he's shaking off rust and he'll look better, but right now Rathbone's looked miles better. Even the AHL guys, whether it be Kalyanuk or Willanen, they've both looked a lot better too. So I just don't see enough with DeKaiser right now to be comfortable that he can help the NHL team.
Yeah, a couple of other defensemen I wanted to get into, but the Brock Besser news obviously has taken us up for time, and there's a lot to dive into. So maybe on the next episode, we'll get a little more of a sample size on Tucker Poolman and what he's shown us from a health perspective, because I think he needs to play a little bit more for us to know that he can sustain that. And also Jack Rathbone, who I thought looked very good in the first preseason game, including on the power play. And I've heard great things about what he did in the 3 days in Whistler. So, but again, a bigger sample size probably required for both players. So we'll get into that. When we come back, more on Hoglander, more on Podkolzin, and a lot more as the VanCast continues.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So, Harm, let's get into Nils Hoglander. Now, coming into the season, coming into training camp, the Canucks put Hoglander on line five, essentially. Put him in with a couple of other Swedes that certainly have an opportunity to see some time with the big club this year, but clearly not one of the top four projected lines. Now, he did get that opportunity in Calgary in game one, but a lot of that also had to do with the fact that Brock Besser isn't quite ready to play yet. So they were able to move some things around and get him onto essentially what looked like a fourth line. So as we look at Nils Hoglander, and Bruce Boudreau says he was our best player during the first 3 days of training camp, this player clearly understands what's at stake for him at this camp. He's been hearing what people are saying in terms of maybe Abbotsford's the best place for him. Let's eliminate the injury possibility right now, as we don't know what's going on with Mikheyev. We don't know what's going on with Brock Besser. But based on what you've seen, is he pounding on the door to get a spot in that top nine or maybe top 12 if they're looking at him on a fourth line in the first preseason game?
100% he is. The way that he's been since day one of Whistler, he's been flying all up and down the ice. Boudreau mentioned that he looked a lot faster moving in a straight line, which is, I think we saw a bit of that progression from his rookie to sophomore year. Now we're seeing another step in that regard from years two to three, which is huge because for Hoglander, we've always known that he's had the elusive Edgerick, the way he can spin and turn off of checks. But for him to fly faster north-south, that has a big impact for how quickly he can close plays on the forecheck, how quickly he can attack off the rush. And he just seemed to have a lot of jump right from the first drills that we saw, which is also important because, remember, he's coming off of a hip injury that caused him to miss the end of the season. So it would have been easy to think about him potentially shaking off some rust and needing some time to get back up to speed. But he was flying, and he just had a sharpness about his game with the way that he was able to make plays with the puck, whether it was as a playmaker, cutting to the inside, which I think has been the biggest asset we've seen from him, both in some of the scrimmages and in the preseason game yesterday. I saw was he's looked dynamic enough to, off of the rush, be able to cut into the slot, and his shot has popped in drills, which was a bit of an issue last season where the finishing wasn't there, right? Höglander would create a lot of chances for himself, but he just wouldn't be able to bury it. It was kind of like watching Nikolai Goldobin all those years ago, where he'd be in some of these prime offensive situations, just wasn't able to hunker down. And I think we've seen Höglander a bit more confident as a finisher, a bit more confident as a shooter throughout camp and preseason so far. And when I look at this Höglander situation, the thing that I keep thinking back to is healthy competition is good for an organization. I'm looking at Höglander and I'm like, he looks way more dynamic. He looks like a player that's leveled up. He knows that he can't rest on his laurels, and everybody in that forward group needs to be at their best because there are legitimate jobs at risk here. Like, do you remember Farhan in 2021 when all Höglander had to do was beat out Louis Erickson and Jake Virtanen for a spot with Bo Horvat?
So true.
It blows my mind away. That was only a year ago. That was in 2021 when Bo Horvat's best options to play in the top six going into camp before Höglander broke out were Louis Erickson or Jake Virtanen. And now we're in the spot where the club's top nine depth is a lot stronger. And now and that results in some of these healthy competitions. And so absolutely, Höglander's looked like one of the best players in camp. And there's obviously the shiny toy effect with Andre Kuzmenko. And I think he showed a lot of potential. But if Höglander was, if fans had never seen Höglander before, if Höglander was all of a sudden wearing Kuzmenko's jersey, I think everybody would be going nuts over the potential in his game. Now, in having said that, it's just Whistler. He has to prove it in the preseason games. I thought in Calgary, he had a good first period. And after that, though, he took a couple of penalties, especially one in the second period, which was close to the offensive zone, which he can't be a liability in terms of his discipline and in terms of his defensive game. So he needs to carry that momentum through into the actual preseason games. But so far, so good in terms of Höglander. And the other thing to point out is when you look at his performance last season, I think it looked worse than it actually was because he was unlucky and due for better bounces. And what I mean by that is when you look at Höglander's profile at 5-on-5, his on-ice shooting percentage was below 6%. That means that the inverse of that, essentially, in other words, was that goalies had a .941 save percentage when Höglander was on the ice. That includes starters, number ones, backups, the worst goalies in the league, all of them combined. They were better than Igor Shesterkin when Höglander was on the ice. That's just not going to last, even if Höglander's a below average finisher. And the result of that is, essentially, Höglander would, both individually and for his line mates, create a lot of chances. But even some of the passes that he would set up as a playmaker, they weren't ending up in the back of the net where they usually would. And that does wonders in terms of changing perception. So his on-ice shooting percentage is going to regress upward. It just is. Not even grinders have an on-ice shooting percentage that low. So I think as that bounces back too, I think there's real potential for him to make an NHL impact. Now we just have to see if he can sort of translate that strong training camp into the actual preseason games.
Yeah, as I read all the reports about him in training camp, it just felt like 2 years ago because those were the exact same reports that I was giving out when I was at camp about how this kid looked. So obviously 2 years bigger, 2 years stronger, and 2 years more experienced. And hopefully, like you say, if he gets the opportunity, he can take advantage of it because, you know, he certainly has found money, right? I mean, not being a first-round pick, yes, he was still, you know, a little bit higher up there. But when you looked at what he was able to show and potentially bring 2 years ago, like that's what you need from deeper in your system, if you know what I'm saying.
100%. And even if Höglander doesn't necessarily make the jump right away, let's say there's a scenario where he has a good camp in preseason, but Mikheyev and Besser end up being healthy, and the club goes, well, if Hoglander isn't going to be in the top nine, we want to send him to Abbotsford. Even that scenario is totally fine because Hoglander has been so fast-tracked and is so ahead of the curve developmentally. When you look at the 2019 draft class, I think there are less than five players, including Hoglander, that have played as many games as he has. It's there are barely any guys that have sort of carved themselves out as full-time players for multiple NHL seasons, and the ones that have are mostly the lottery pick guys like Jack Hughes and Kirby Dach and players that were selected in that top five. So Hoglander is a second round pick, even if he's unable to force himself into a top nine role, and he has to, let's say, spend a bit of time in Abbotsford, that's fine for his development.
One other young player, we talked about the shiny toy effect with Kuzmenko. You know, obviously there's going to be an adjustment for him getting used to the North American ice, the physicality and pace. You know, there were questions around his fitness. How big of a concern is that? And how do you see the early stages of his adjustment so far? Again, not just through the one preseason game, but through what we saw in training camp in Whistler.
Yeah, I mean, the conditioning is definitely something for him to work on. I think through the first couple of days at camp, it was his line would go through drills and Pettersson would look like he's not really breaking a sweat and Kuzmenko would be bent over and kind of out of breath in certain situations. I don't think it's like, I'm not trying to make this a big storyline or anything. It's not this massive concern. It's not Jake Virtanen showing up to camp out of shape and being thrown into group C, right? So conditioning he needs to improve on, but I'm not too worried about in the grand scheme of things. I think he'll be able to catch up to speed on that. In terms of him applying a skill set, for me, it's more, can he consistently make the right NHL reads? Because I think right off the bat, we see the skill is flashy and glamorous, right? The man can put on an absolute show with his hands. He has creative dekes for days when attacking defenders one-on-one off the rush, but his defensive game is a bit of a work in progress. And it's not because of a lack of work rate, right? Because Kuzmenko, when you talk to people even over in Russia and some of the executives over there, they'll tell you he's always been a hard worker, but it's about understanding the right spots to be in defensively, and the awareness is the better way to put it. Because there was a play, for example, in the first scrimmage where, and again, this is the first scrimmage, so you expect these hiccups. There's supposed to be a long runway. I'm not trying to blow this up as an issue. I'm just trying to point out that, hey, in the first scrimmage, for example, there was a play where Pettersson and Mikheyev were aggressively hunting a puck down on the forecheck. The opposition's defensemen were able to beat Pettersson and Mikheyev up the ice, and Kuzmenko was essentially sort of skating backwards as the third forward in an F3 position. The opposing team sort of dumped it into the right corner, the side that Kuzmenko was on. And it was in that situation, Kuzmenko's job to turn around and retrieve the puck and at least sort of engage in a battle. Probably should have been first to the puck, but he seemed a little bit unsure, hesitant about, am I supposed to go back for this puck? And he didn't go at all. And in that scenario, the forechecker was able to get the puck uncontested and it led to a goal against, right? And those are some of the reads that it's going to take him time to learn. And I'm not too worried about it right off the bat, because I think about, well, what did Vasily Podkolzin look like through training camp and preseason? And Vasily Podkolzin, because of how many adjustments there were, it took him time. There was a significant learning curve. He also looked lost at times. And of course, we saw once Podkolzin was able to catch a stride midseason, he was able to make a strong impact. So it's normal. It's expected for Kuzmenko to have some of these bumps in the road, especially since we're only through one game of preseason that he's had. The potential we've seen has been really fascinating, though. Like the takeaway that I have is not only is this a guy who, if he can figure out the defensive side and the conditioning and the fitness, not only could he make an impact in the middle six, but could he be a full-time top six guy? And I don't want to get ahead of myself, but he's looked really dangerous attacking as a scorer. He's been explosive. The move that really caught my eye in Whistler was he's kind of like Garland, where he's not a burner. He's got average speed in a straight line, but coming out of corners, he can explode with his edge work. And what he would do is he'd be in a corner off the cycle, explode out of a turn, shake a defender off, and immediately attack the net, take the puck there. And that's where Kuzmenko spoke about how the smaller ice surface could actually help him. Because in the KHL, when you make that turn out of the corner, you're still far from the net, as opposed to when the ice is smaller and you make that turn out of the corner, you can immediately attack the net. And we saw him pull that move off over and over again. His shot has been explosive. Boudreau kind of said that the release kind of reminds him of Ovechkin.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that was, and he obviously qualified it by saying, I don't want to set the bar, you know, too lofty. But in his words, Boudreau was like, yeah, the release is explosive. It was a little bit like Ovi's. And so I think he's going to be dangerous off the rush. In terms of the fit as a line with Pettersson and Mikheyev, if he's able to stay healthy, the one thing that I do realize in watching that line play is Pettersson is going to have to carry the bulk of the load as a playmaker, at least to start, because Mikheyev doesn't have that playmaking side in his game. And while the reports at Russia were about, hey, he's got a lot of potential as a playmaker, again, I think he's looked a lot more dangerous as a scorer and as a shooter than he necessarily has as a playmaker.
You're talking Mikheyev, not Kuzmenko.
Sorry, Kuzmenko, okay. As well. Doesn't have there is playmaking potential in his game for sure, but he hasn't quite shown it yet. Again, I think he's looked way more dangerous as a scorer with his shot than he has as a setup guy. And that means if Pettersson has two wingers that are both primarily, at least for now, shooters, that means Pettersson's going to have to be more of a setup guy, both off the rush, in zone offensively. And when Pettersson's at his best, he has that in his game. But it just is a sort of stylistic thing to keep in mind. But there's something there. There's potential, and obviously a lot of kinks to work out with Kuzmenko. But I think it's exciting to see the potential in his game so far.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, I do want to get into Pettersson, as you mentioned, because I think he put on a bit of a show last night. Might not have all ended up on the scoreboard, but did some great things in the preseason game, much like he's shown in camp so far. And also Podkolzin when we return. So, Harm, let's get into Pettersson, who last night... Yeah.
I've got a trivia question for you.
All right.
Last season...
I'm not good at trivia,
you've got three
now.
Guesses for this. That's fine. I believe in you, Farhan.
All
last
right.
season, who's the only NHL team to go undefeated in the preseason?
Three guesses. Wasn't the Vancouver Canucks. The Calgary Flames?
Nope.
It had to be a team that missed the playoffs, which is why you're asking the question.
I'm not giving any hints.
Come on. Team to, let's see, to win the preseason, to go undefeated in the preseason. The Vegas Golden Knights.
No.
Tell me.
The Arizona Coyotes.
Of course, that's right. Louis put on a show.
And not only Arizona, but in 2016, the Avs went undefeated in preseason and then went on to have a 48-point campaign,
yeah.
A historically awful season. I just thought that was funny.
So what you're telling me now is Calgary at 2-0 is in trouble.
Yes, and that the Canucks at 0-2 are in a really good position.
Yeah, the things you learn on this show. What we're also about to teach you is that Elias Pettersson's pretty darn good. You know, certainly a different looking Pettersson to the start of this preseason and training camp than what we saw a year ago, because we didn't see him at the start of training camp as he was dealing with some of those types of issues that kept him out with the contract situation and whatnot. You know, he's looked his dominant playmaking self in Whistler, and I thought he looked great last night. I mean, there were some plays that he made, including setting up Garland. Garland needed two whacks to get it in, but just a perfect seeing eye cross crease pass. And he made a few of those. He was dynamic. Just what are we expecting from Elias Pettersson at the start of this season? Because my expectations are big. I am expecting Pettersson to be an 80-point player this year, and I think it's going to start right out of the gate.
I think 80 minimum, in my opinion. I really, and maybe that's setting the bar too high, and I'm not necessarily saying that just off of a strong camp or preseason. It's just the potential in his game, and This is the third year now. So, I mean, I'm hoping the third time's a charm, where I've sort of been expecting Pettersson to kind of take that next big step, because after the bubble year, we were talking about him as this sort of, and it's not just in the Vancouver market, around the league, people were talking about him as a top 10 center in the game. I remember there were points where national media, Elliot Friedman, was talking about him in the 2019-20 season when the Canucks were pushing for that playoff spot as, wow, is Pettersson a dark horse, an outside sort of guy for the Hart, right? That's the sort of rarefied air Pettersson was being discussed in. And obviously 2021 gets off to a non-characteristic start, but in a season that's with the North Division and with totally different COVID guidelines, that season was kind of a write-off. And then last season, misses camp and preseason, kind of rehabbing a wrist injury. Now he's in a much better spot. He's got the confidence of ending the second half of the season on a completely dominant note. He's completely healthy. And from what I was told, he came back last summer, this past summer, really, really motivated. I think he started his off-season training earlier than usual. Everything I've been told is he's really dialed in and really desperate to lead this team to the playoffs. And I think he understands the responsibility of, I've got to lead the way. And so far in camp, he's looked really sharp. He's looked really dialed in, kind of similar to how we saw in Victoria in that 2019-20 season when he was such a huge contributor. I think in that year, the team's best forward, if I'm being honest. And it's not just the offensive side we've seen from him so far, but even in the scrimmages and even through the highlights of what I was able to catch in the game last night, the two-way side of his game, he's looked like the Canucks' best defensive center so far, which is really important because when Elias Pettersson is at his best, he's consistently breaking plays up. That's one thing you'll notice. Remember when the Lotto line was consistently rolling? It wasn't just about flashy plays off the rush. It was about Pettersson and that line breaking a ton of plays up on the forecheck. They were a forechecking behemoth, the three of them, the way they were able to close on plays, the way Pettersson was able to read and anticipate plays. Defensemen just weren't able to break the puck out against that Pettersson line. It wasn't just about, this is a really skilled line and they own the puck all the time. A big part of it was, hey, we chip and chase and we can dominate you from a two-way perspective as well. And so it's been really nice to see that part of his game, to see Pettersson on the back check, to see him above the play. And the reason it translates so well in terms of when he's playing really well defensively, he's also usually dominant offensively, is because the common trait there is his reads. When Pettersson is reading the game better than anybody else, that's when you see him making the sorts of passes that we saw to, for example, Connor Garland. And that applies defensively as well, to where he's able to jump a passing lane earlier than anybody else can anticipate, where he's able to stay above the puck and support the play defensively really well. So I've really enjoyed seeing that part of his game. And yeah, my expectations are sky high just because of the potential we've seen. And I think it's time, and I think he knows it's time to have a huge season.
Well, it is also theoretically a platform year, right? Because they can then renegotiate the extension next offseason if they so choose, if I'm not mistaken.
For sure. And the last thing you want is, I think you don't want the perception of being a guy that only shows up for the contract year, right? The season matters a lot for his contract, but it's not necessarily his platform year per se. The one thing Pettersson would want to avoid is, let's say, having a middling season this year, and then the next year, when it is actually his platform year, going off and having a huge season. Because people look at, for example, Johnny Gaudreau, right? Johnny Gaudreau has been inconsistent, and then he had this massive MVP caliber type year. There were a lot of executives, I'll tell you, who looked at that and went, well, yeah, of course, it's his contract year. Yeah. And in their minds, they went, Gaudreau's not actually going to be that year in, year out. He's just doing that because it's his contract year. He's really bearing down. And a lot of teams then looked at that as, okay, they didn't view him as an MVP type player. They didn't view him as 115 point guy or whatever he was able to manage. You don't want that if you're Elias Pettersson. You want to have a dominant season this year and then to prove it again in your platform year, so that there's no doubt in management's mind that he's whatever, a 90-point guy while still being a dominant two-way player. So I think that's why it's really important for him to have that big breakout this season, because yeah, there is the possibility he can negotiate that big deal this offseason.
No, you're right. It's not as likely to happen until the following year, because the club still has one more year of club control. You were right. So even though there's still you want it to happen before the final year of his deal, they still have control the year after that.
Yes. But again, I still think it's really, really important because, again, teams will just view it a lot differently. It's expected that guys will just bear down and have a big year during their contract years. I mean, look at the last free agency class, whether it was Gaudreau, whether it was Kadri, whether it was Philip Forsberg. The list goes on and on of guys that just had career years, and you just don't want to be, you want to prove it's sustainable, is my point.
Yeah, no doubt. Before we wrap it up here, I do want to talk a bit about Pod Colson. I thought he looked fantastic last night. I thought he was strong on the puck and, you know, looks like he's ready to take that next step. They've got him kind of penciled in on a line along with Garland and Horvat, which to me seems like a pretty good fit, given the completeness of his game to play alongside of Bo and how complete that player is, and just kind of how the club could potentially deploy them in a number of high leverage situations. Just what's your takeaway on the jump that he's made? Because, you know, you always worry about the sophomore slump with a number of these guys. Certainly we saw with Hoglander a year ago. I don't see that coming with Pod Colson, just because of the style of his play and just the maturity he's got.
I don't either. And out of all of the top three, top nine lines Bruce Boudreau constructed, I think I liked the shape and the stylistic fit of Garland, Horvat, Pod Colson the most, because there's that similarity between Horvat and Pod Colson in terms of playing that straight line, north-south game, being strong physically, dominating down low, and then combining that with Garland's playmaking ability, because Horvat and Pod Colson are both pretty good finishers. And there you have Garland, who, you look at the numbers last season, he led the club with 25-5 primary assists. I think the next best Canuck next Canucks forward was Miller with only 12 primary 5-5 assists. I'll have to double check on how far the distance was, but the point is Garland is a great playmaker at 5-on-5 with the way he's able to twist and turn. And I like that fit with Pod Colson in terms of a guy who can get him the puck. And with Pod Colson too, the biggest difference I think we might notice is the confidence element. It's not necessarily about him taking a big stride in terms of his physical attributes. And it's the mental game for me, because when you look at the context of the way that he's been able to come up and the transition to Russia, this is a player who has always, in terms of an offensive sense, always deferred to playing it safe rather than taking risks to make a bold play. Because you have to understand the psychology. When he was in SKA, when he was in the KHL, he was playing a fourth line role. If he made a single mistake, he was immediately benched. And you talk to people that knew Pod Colson well over in Russia, they would say that playing on that SKA team, which was a contender there, he felt like he was kind of stepping on eggshells. And that's why it maybe even at the NHL level took him a little bit of time to break out of his shell, just because he's been conditioned to, I've got to take care of my own end and make sure that I don't make any mistakes before I even try things offensively. And I think in the second half of last season, especially down the stretch when he got an opportunity in the top six, when injuries were striking, we saw him take more chances. We saw the confidence in his game grow. We saw the evolution of, hey, I'm comfortable making plays in the defensive zone. I'm comfortable in the breakout. Now the next step is I can actually try things with my offensive skill set. And we saw him carrying the puck a little bit more through the neutral zone. And now through preseason, you see that goal where he's driving to the net. To me, that's all confidence. That's all mental. That's all a player that's going, I'm familiar with this league now. I know the language a lot better. I know the ice surface a lot better. I'm way more comfortable with NHL reads. I'm comfortable with Horvat and Garland with my line mates because I've played with them at points last season. I'm comfortable with Boudreau as my coach. I know he can be trusted from a two-way perspective. I know I can score with him having put up 14 goals. And it's just him now having a little bit more swagger in his game. And that's what I'm really excited to see heading into this season.
Yeah, and I think they're going to keep that line together even with this injury to Besser now. Again, as we told you earlier in the show, 3 to 4 weeks. He's just had surgery on his hand, successful surgery, so he's going to be out for a little bit. And we'll, again, we've still got to see what's going to happen with Mikheyev in terms of how the lines wind up being constructed for this team. I think they're going to keep that line together with Horvat, but we'll see how it plays out. Before we go, I got to ask you, like, did you golf at all in Whistler?
Not in the Whistler, but in Penticton. And I've got to say, Faber and I went up, and keep in mind, I've never played a full round of golf before. I've done pitch and putt once in my life. And so we thought
you and
we were
I
going
need to play
and
together.
And
we're at about the same pace.
Yeah, so we thought we were going to pitch and putt, and we go, and it's this fantastic, I think it was the WOW golf course or something. And it was, you know, you saw Lake Okanagan, I think it was in the background, just picturesque. But we wind up there, and it's like, oh my God, the first hole is 450 yards. I'm like, Faber, I don't see the flag. Is there, like, are we sure we're on the right hole? And it was an absolute nightmare. I was just slicing with the driver everywhere, and it got to the point where we I think by hole 3 or 4 we're like, all right, we're just gonna take the cart halfway down the fairway and just start with our 4 irons from there. And that seemed to help things because we were shanking balls left and right. And Faber's actually played a lot of golf, so I felt a little bit less bad that, hey, even at the start for him, he was slicing them. But it was an absolute disaster until we started cheating and making it actually like 150, 200 yards.
Well, I'm going to have to watch that myself at one point and just see how far you can get this thing. But listen, we're going to call it a wrap. Tough news for the Canucks going into this, you know, just to lose Besser the way it's gone down. And, you know, for the player and for the team, you know, we certainly expected big things from Brock this year. A little bit of clarity with all the weight he was under last season with the health of his father. But hopefully he's able to come back bigger, stronger, faster. We're going to have a live room edition of the VanCast on Thursday following the Canucks game against the Kraken. Stay tuned for details on that. We'll give you an exact time, and you know how it works. It's kind of late in the game and in the process right before we go on air, where we will send you where to log in and listen. But we're looking forward to doing our first one of the year there. If you're looking for other pod options, Bill Zito, the GM of the Florida Panthers, is Craig Custance and Sean Gentile's guest Tuesday on the Athletic Hockey Show. As for us, thanks for listening to the VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. And this offer still remains. Get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. Harmon and I will be back next week. For Harm, I'm Farhan. Thanks for listening to the VanCast.